Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hello, everyone. I am Molly.
I'm Kai, and this is Make Me Smart. It's our new weekly podcast where we explore the things we want to know more about in business and technology and culture and all that good stuff. And also, we do it with help from you. My day job, I host Marketplace. It's a radio show.
You may know him as Kai Rizdahl.
You
from... might. We'll just go full Simpsons on it. You may know me as Molly Woods, senior tech correspondent at Marketplace as well. But this is our departure. This is our time to find out what we had for breakfast, if you will.
Really?
That's my weird favorite part of radio interviews, is that in the sound check, everybody finds out, you know, what you had, and I feel like you learn so much about people based on what they had for breakfast. So much.
I had sourdough toast with a little olive oil, a whole avocado chopped up and put on it with some salt. And I ate it in the car on the way to work, which people are going to yell at me about that, actually.
Really? Compared to all the other things that are happening in cars these days, people are going to yell at you about avocado toast?
I don't know.
I only think it's adorable that you didn't call it avocado toast. Like, you don't want to sound too bougie.
Oh, yeah.
So you're like, well, what I had was toast
with avocado. Yeah,
that happened to have some avocado on it. I had my child's leftover toasted waffle that I'd put jelly on because he said that he wanted that, but then he didn't eat it. So I just slapped some peanut butter on there and rolled the whole thing up and ate it cold. Because I was like, whatever.
Oh, my God.
Go,
that
go.
That just grosses me out, man.
I know. You
that
learned
is
a lot.
Terrible. Oh, more than I wanted to know. But anywho, so what we're going to do this week, we're going to do the standard thing that we are going to do every show, which is a little news fix up top, what is going on and why it matters and how Molly and I are thinking about it, and maybe some thoughts from y'all on what else is going on. We'll bring an interview, I think, this week, right, Molly?
We will, and I am excited about this interview. We're talking about the future of artificial intelligence, which relates to a lot of the things that we've been talking about on the Marketplace program, of course, mm-hmm. because it gets at, you know, what is the future of jobs? What is the, you know, the future of humanity? And so we brought in a very smart man to talk about those issues with. And more.
And more. So the other thing we're going to do is Molly and I will usually do joint interviews when we can, but other times it's going to be one of us or the other of us sitting and doing an interview with somebody. I spoke this week with Norman Lear and had a great conversation with him and his co-creator of the reboot of One Day at a Time, which is on Netflix, which is going to air on Marketplace. But we asked him... Norman Lear, of course, the guy who started Maude and All in the Family and One Day at a Time. He's 94 and amazing. And we asked him the Make Me Smart question, which is, you know, what did you think you knew about that maybe you didn't? What did you get smart about in the course of your life? And his answer, I'm going to tell you right now, and this may be just setting this up a little bit too much, but it is unbelievable.
Yeah, unbelievable. I don't think that's an overstatement.
Yeah.
And I want to go back to what Kai just said, which is that is going to be a regular thing on our show. That's our question. That is it, because I think that's, you know, we started off last week, we had this wonderful answer, which was, what did you know you didn't know before? And it was, I learned how to learn in my life. I mean, just, you know, it's a really, it gets great gets great answers. And so that is going to be an ongoing piece, segment of this show. But speaking of regular segments, let's kick off this one by getting our fix. The news fix.
It is the news fix. It's what's going on out there and why it matters, really. And I'm going to start this one by offering up, it's a mathematical thing, but I'm going to apply it to politics and culture and technology and business and what's going on. And that is this, Molly Wood, chaos theory.
Right? Yes.
Do I need to discuss what's going on? We have so much going on in the political environment today that is affecting tech and business and culture. That it's very tough to keep one's eye on the ball. And that sort of is just a way to start off the discussion of some of the things that are happening. I'm just going to run down a list, and Molly, climb in with more if you can think of it. So there was, of course, the executive order on immigration on Friday afternoon. But happening elsewhere in the news was stuff like a huge turnover, an extremely unusual turnover at the State Department, right? Yep. There was the dismissal of the acting attorney general, and we can debate whether that was justified or not. There was the reorganization of the National Security Council. There was a raid in Yemen in which an American Special Forces guy was killed and an 8-year-old American citizen girl was killed, which has not gotten a whole lot of press. Wow. What else is going on? What are you thinking of that's like chaotic?
All of that. There's the White House warning that State Department officials, there are rumors that there may be essentially a memo of dissent from within the State Department about the immigration order in particular, not to mention what appears to be the dissolution. There's some confusion about what's happening with employees at the State Department. At first, it was reported as a mass resignation, and then reports emerged later that in fact, it might have been a firing. And that you know, power is quickly sort of being consolidated with a small group of people that includes Steve Bannon and doesn't include traditional intelligence sources. So you have a lot going on and a lot of people only talking about the one thing. So our goal on this show and like Kai's goal in his Twitter feed, is to say, hey, here's the big thing that you're all talking about, but let's please make sure that we look behind the curtain at what's happening, because some of this stuff really, to use our kind of the normal versus not normal metric that we sort of set up last week, that I think is going to be a useful architecture for us going forward. A lot of the things that are happening in terms of the reorganization of the federal government are not necessarily normal, although, and I would be interested in your thoughts here, are a bit of an extension of what we saw toward the end of the Obama administration in terms of the power of the presidency.
That's really interesting, right? So the imperial presidency, which has been a thing since like Nixon or maybe even before. But let me back you up for a second. Sorry, I got to write this down, imperial presidency. On this whole normal, not normal thing, right? We did set up that thing, that sort of framing last week, and it certainly applies this week. Like, if you look at that immigration order, right, there is a lot that's in there that had they handled the rollout differently, everybody would have gone, oh, man, this is bad, but it's what a Republican administration would do. But what you're seeing, just to get it back to the chaos theory thing, is you're seeing the chaotic rollout of this thing, which is then cascading through various levels of society and business and culture and technology, and people are losing sight of the bigger thing, which is the consolidation of power, as near as we can tell, in the White House, in this small group of advisors around the president. Now, the imperial presidency, I mean, Barack Obama was no fan of transparency. He was a great expansionist of federal powers. Look at drones and all of that stuff. Since really, literally Richard Nixon, presidents have successively built on the powers expanded by their predecessors. And so Donald Trump will, because he is now in the office, he's going to do the exact same thing. I mean, he just totally, totally will. And it's honestly, it's normal. It's to be expected. What might be happening is outside the norm, but, you know.
Well, yeah, it's becoming the new normal, and it gets normal with every successive administration. And look, even, you know, we can play a clip from it. There's even a Saturday Night Live cold open from, 2014, about the power of the executive order, right? Like, they reimagined the awesome I'm Just a Bill Schoolhouse Rock moment.
I'm an executive order, and I pretty much just happened.
And he's smoking a cigarette. And then they do the whole thing. Yeah, he goes, don't you have to go through Congress? And he goes, oh, that's adorable. Okay, but this is a thing. The expansion of presidential powers, like you said, is in fact a trend, and it is helped along by the dysfunction of Congress. There's a study out of Stanford from 2016, last fall, saying that the presidency has emerged as the strongest of the three branches of U.S. government. Now we have an administration that is taking full advantage of that power. And what's interesting now is looking at who is responding, right? Because Congress remains relatively unresponsive or dysfunctional, however you want to look at it.
Both.
But this is the week that business came off the bench.
It was amazing, actually. It was amazing to see business come up and say, listen, we disagree with this. It is not good for our employees. It is not good for our customers. And you had it across the spectrum. Tech, to its very great credit, started first, right? Being the first one out of the foxhole is always a scary thing. But Mark Zuckerberg on Friday afternoon was the first one who said, you know what, this is something that we cannot agree with. But then it trickled down through finance. I mean, you saw Lloyd Blankfein at Goldman Sachs and Jamie Dimon at J.P. Morgan. A lot of companies now. Jeff Bezos is suing the federal government over this thing?
Yeah. Or at least pursuing legal options. Right. Pursuing legal options.
Yeah, well, so let's not.
I mean, it's pretty. That is a pretty remarkable. That is a remarkable development
in
terms of this normal versus not normal. The idea that the head of a major U.S. business, a major global power, by the way, and so it leads into the conversation about where power is starting to lie less and less with Congress, more and more with the presidency, but also, and I think we've been saying this since the beginning, since Trump was elected, business being ascendant is a big part of President Trump's election.
Oh, yeah, totally.
A big part of the agenda. And now that those business interests are coming and saying, hey, whoa, won't somebody think about the economy? Even pro-economic growth Republican think tanks are concerned about the effect of these immigration policies. Should they be extended indefinitely?
Some guy tweeted at me today, listen, are you going to talk about this? And what he was talking about was business in this new environment that we are all having to live in, where things are happening with what looks to the outside world no real plan. And my response basically is this. President Trump campaigned on blowing up the establishment, but the thing is that the businesses in this country are the establishment, and now they are having to choose between standing up for customers and consumers and their employees in the face of a visa ban and all kinds of things like that, or being worried about the president of the United States tweeting at them and costing them X percent on their share price on any given day, you know, which is a remarkable, remarkable state of affairs, because the businesses in this country, I'll say it again, are the establishment. Can I go on a little bit of more of a rant on business and laws?
Please.
Okay. All right. So I said this the other day on Marketplace, and I'm going to say it again here. One of the reasons that what happened with the immigrant travel ban that was issued by the White House via executive order is this. We are a nation of laws. Laws here mean something. And when you invest in the United States, in a company here, in the American Treasury market, when you put your money into this economy, you are counting on the fact that the law treats everyone equally. Without that guarantee, without that realization that you will be treated equally, with a thing that happens like the immigrant visa ban, where a lawful permanent resident of the United States can be banned from coming here, and yes, it's been walked back, but when that happens, without recourse to Congress or the courts, then a stock or a bond is just a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just bad for the entire capitalist system that this country has developed on. And I don't know where we go with that.
Well, where you go, interestingly, is to the central question of whether business becomes one of the systems of checks and balances.
Oh, wow.
And I think the takeaway about business.
I'm just a little company, right? That's great.
Exactly.
No, that's a really good thing, right? Business being a check and balance. That's really interesting. Wow.
I think that may end up being, like, if you look at the trend that's developing now, the dots that I will connect, the trend that I will predict is that may be something that happens, and that it is a natural outcropping of the fact that business has become so ascendant in terms of setting policy, lobbying, Citizens United, right? So if indeed business, as the Supreme Court has ruled, is essentially, if corporate interests are essentially able to act as an individual within our democracy, then it is not a surprise, and it is in fact incumbent on them to act in their own best interest, and their own best interests may turn out not to be solely about shareholder value.
That, honest to God, is the smartest thing I've heard all day. The idea of businesses being part of the businesses as it happens now, right, with the new Trump economy, being part of the checks and balances in a capitalist constitutionalist system. That's awesome. That freaking rocks. All right. We are now at the point where we got to do some other stuff. So she's at Molly Wood on Twitter. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Keep them coming. Questions, comments, answers, what have you. It's marketplace.org/makemesmart. Coming up next.
We're about to talk to, or we talked with Scott Phoenix. He's the co-founder of a company called Vicarious and the CEO of a company called Vicarious, which does artificial intelligence technology development with sort of in a way that you have not heard before.
And this guy is a thinker that in a way that just blows me away, honestly. All right, we're back. I'm Kai.
I'm Molly.
And this is Make Me Smarter. It's a podcast on what's going on out there, what Molly and I have to say about it, and also what y'all have to say about it. Every week, your comments, your thoughts, our interviews, and some really amazing tape. And the tape that we're about to play is a conversation that Molly and I had with a guy by the name of Scott Phoenix, runs a company called Vicarious. Molly, tell him what Scott does.
Yeah, so this company is working on pretty serious artificial intelligence research and technology. And it's interesting. They have so much funding from so many sources in Silicon Valley that the main goal of the company is just to sort of investigate. Like, they'll put out a product eventually, but they are literally so well funded and people are so interested in the technology that they're developing that they're like, take your time. Just get it right. It's fascinating.
It's the coolest thing. Here's the tape.
I have to say that Kai is at a total disadvantage here.
You know, I'm the odd man out. I'm used to that.
He's barely getting a word in because Scott and I are in the same room here in Emeryville.
Molly, we're having such a great connection here. I just don't know.
We're just hanging out. We're having beers.
But we've got the editing razor blade down here, so, you know.
Curses.
I'm just saying.
So we should start with, what is Vicarious?
Yes.
So Vicarious is a 6.5-year-old startup company, and we're working on developing human-like artificial intelligence to make our world a lot more productive and more like the Jetsons than it is today.
Wow. Like with Ruh-Roh George and the dog and everything, the Jetsons? I mean, that's like a vision of the future, dude.
It really is a vision of the future. So Rosie the Robot, the works. Yeah. I think it's funny. We live in this weird world where all the ingredients that go into a robot, the gears and the plastics and the sensors, even the electricity, are all very inexpensive. And yet the average person sees zero robots a year. And so there's this weird paradox between the world we could be living in if only the AI were smarter and the world we live in now.
Okay, so what is it about your AI that is so much smarter?
I think it's the way I like to think about it is the difference between old brain animals and mammals. So for the last 600 million years, we've had intelligent animals roam the earth, things like jellyfish and flatworms and sea sponges. And these are animals that are capable of doing lots of different complicated behaviors. They can hunt for food, they can avoid predators, they can mate. But what you're really seeing them do, by and large, is a complicated set of scripted behaviors, pre-programmed behaviors. And so they're not very versatile. They're not that able to learn complex new skills or form language or use tools. Some of them are to a limited degree, but by and large, the old brain, the reptile brain, is all about instincts. And to get to the transition of having a world where most of our robots are kind of like old brain animals, like Roomba.
I've got one of those. I like it.
Exactly.
In my living room, you know.
And there's nothing wrong with sea sponges and flatworms. They're cool. They can do lots of stuff. And Roombas, exactly.
Right.
But to get to this world where we have Rosie the Robot from the Jetsons, we really need a new kind of AI, one that focuses on, instead of just instincts, it focuses on reasoning. And that's the kind of AI that we're working on at Vicarious, at a really high level anyway.
Can we just get this one out of the way right up top? Because there will be people, probably not so many listening to this podcast, actually, but there is a, oh my God, the robots are becoming sentient question to be asked. And so just consider it asked right here.
Like, so can you phrase that as a question?
How much should we worry about
how
that?
Much should we, thank you, Molly. All right, no so problem. It wasn't technically a question. It was a rant.
That's what I anyway. Do on the show.
So I think safety is part of building any new invention. So like from the creation of fire onwards, everything humans have invented can be used to help people or they can be used to do damage. And part of inventing something new is making sure that it's used for humanity's thriving. Hmm. And just like there aren't two fields, bridge engineering and bridge safety, there's just bridge engineering, and part of building a bridge is making sure it doesn't fall down. Part of artificial intelligence is making sure that the systems that you build reliably do the things that you intend them to do and don't have negative unintended consequences. So
yeah, but doesn't thinking, I mean, I just feel like that's how I feel about my kid too. I'm going to raise him as well as I can, but he can think.
Exactly.
So can he, isn't he himself just a walking unintended consequence waiting to happen because he has logic and desires and instincts that I can't always control?
Yeah. So I think that's a really grounded perspective, Molly. I think that the biggest threats that face the world now and will continue to face the world for some time are humans. And that's and to the extent that we can build systems to protect the world from mistakes that humans can make is, I think, a really noble cause and one that should get far more attention than will the robots rise up or not.
Mm-hmm. The question that you have to ask is the what happens when they come for us. But the question that we don't often ask is like, why should we do this? How will it, you know, if our whole history is a story of progress, how far does this take us?
Mm-hmm. How far does AI take us in our large human history?
How far does Rosie? Because it's not just about getting my dishes done, right?
Yeah. It's
although that's awesome.
Yeah, I think it is awesome. But so I think it's all about amplifying the lever from which humans can pull and create new ideas, inventions, and human productivity. Like, I think we're limited right now by our biology, by how few of us there are, how short our lifespans are, and how slow our brains think. And AI is something that, if we do it right, ultimately sets us free from those constraints, and we can live in a much better society than we live in today.
All right, let me be the business and econ geek here just to talk about some of the stuff that's happening in this economy right now, right? Because what you're seeing in the political landscape is a reflection of what's happening in the economic landscape, right? Jobs are being lost not really to outsourcing as the political conversation goes, but to automation. So what happens when we don't, you know, it used to take, I'm making up a number, 1,500 people to make a car, and now it takes 50 because we have robots or automation. What happens when it takes 2 to make a car?
It's an interesting question, and it's one that we've faced many times in the past. So in 1900, 40% of U.S. employment was on farms, and now it's less than 2%. Mm-hmm. So that farm that used to take 400 people to produce food now takes 20 people. And so we've actually been through this transition before in other areas of the economy. And what you see now is that since 1900, the percentage of U.S. adults employed in the labor market is higher than it's ever been, and it's risen almost every decade consistently since 1890.
Look at you with the piece of paper. See, I'm in the studio.
All right, but wait. So let's stay the heck away from a conversation about labor force participation rate. But those jobs on the farm, right, they were lost because people had someplace to go. They went to the cities and got nominally better jobs. Now the jobs in manufacturing here are just flat disappearing. They're vaporizing.
And they're oftentimes being replaced with other jobs. Like I think – or the other case is the case of the automatic teller machine, right? 30 years ago when the automatic teller machine was introduced, it was predicted that it would destroy the bank teller industry. And now there are twice as many bank tellers as there were 30 years ago when the ATM was introduced. So like I think technology always is this double-edged sword where sometimes it creates jobs and sometimes it shifts them. But I think the long arc of human history here is one where – there aren't just less and less things for people to do as we've automated industry after industry. I think what we're seeing is that there's more and more for people to do. Like we're so far from that Jetsons-like society that I think everyone would want to live in. And it's not that we're so far in terms of what we know how to build. We're so far in terms of there's just a lot of work that needs to be done that's not getting done.
So what's the product that you're going to ship eventually?
That's a good question. So it relates to robots. We're not announcing right now what our first product is going to be. But I think to paint it in broad strokes, it's going to be around making robots a lot more useful and flexible than they are today. Right now, the robot industry looks a lot like the computer industry when it first started and everything was a custom chip. And you couldn't just write software for a general architecture and have it work. And so right now, if you want a robot to make candy for you or to do anything for you, you need a whole custom robot that you're only going to order a couple of because it has to be all custom for your specific use case. And I think that we'll see a transition away from robots being these weird specialized things that only do one thing and are tailor-made for each use case to robots being much more general and much more helpful.
Can we talk about the current political climate for a little bit?
Sure.
What changes are you seeing or what changes are you anticipating? Does the potential executive order on H-1B visas affect Vicarious?
It's an interesting question. It's hard for me to play forward in time. But when I look at Vicarious's group of scientists, we employ almost 45 people now, and more than half of them are not from the United States. They're from all over Europe and the rest of the world, really. And they're not here as citizens, but they're here on specialized visas for outstanding scientists. And so it's something that I can imagine, depending on how the administration moves forward with their immigration programs, and it's, I think, pretty unclear at this point what it is that they intend to do or how to do it, it could have effects. I think there are a lot of brilliant scientists in the world, not just in the United States, and to lose access to them I think would be a really detrimental to America's productivity.
We got a listener question off of Facebook today. The guy's name is Nate Strong, and he asks a very Asimovian laws of robotics question. He wants to know if AI can be taught to lie, which seemed to me like a good question.
Can be taught to lie. I mean, even the structure of the question implies a lot about the architecture of the system. And I think that's one of the things that sometimes escapes people and the press in writing about AI safety. Like, there's this famous scenario called paper clipping where you have an AI that you ask to make paper clips, and it gets so enthusiastic about making paper clips, it turns the entire planet Earth and all of the people who live here into paper clips. And I think that what this scenario—
You're not making your case, man. Holy cow.
Well, I mean, I think it's a silly scenario for the reason that the AI that's smart enough— I mean, to be smart enough to turn the entire planet into paperclips is like so beyond what's capable for any human being. And so that AI that's smart enough to do that and simultaneously not smart enough to know what a person means when they say they'd like a paperclip is a contradiction. And so that's, I think, part of the essence of some of these thoughts. So going back to the reader's question about like, is there, maybe you could say it back to me.
Sure. It's can AI be taught to lie? Yeah.
Yeah. So can AI be taught to lie implies a certain kind of architecture that the AI will have and that you're teaching it things the way you teach a human things, and its brain is opaque to you the way a human's brain is opaque to you. And I'm not convinced that that's going to be the architecture for generally intelligent systems. It may, in fact, be that we can see perfectly into the brains of the AIs we build and know for certain what it is that they're thinking and believing. It may be that the solution to AI is one that's actually – it's physically impossible for the AI to lie just because of the nature of the solution to the problem. We don't know enough yet about what is the right architecture for building machines that are intelligent to even know what the concept of lying is, to really make strong claims about, oh, we can or can't teach them how to lie or whatever it is.
Is this the kind of stuff you think about every day? I mean, that's a serious question, right? Because those are deep fundamental thoughts about the nature of what you're doing.
Yeah, I mean, it's a conversation that is ongoing at Vicarious and at other places that are working on these problems. We talk about the right way to design intelligent systems, and all of those design considerations have implications for how the system performs and what it can and can't do and how we relate to it, how we debug it. And so that's an active part of our conversation, you know, and not in the grandiose kinds of terms that I think the questions that you're asking frame it in. But certainly from a tactical bridge engineering level, we are always thinking about what are the right representations, what are the right inference algorithms, and how do we make a system that behaves predictably and, you know, is scrutable and so on.
It's so interesting to hear you talk about what is essentially what will probably become at some point, even if it's, you know, 500 years from now, like philosophy as code.
Right.
Behavior as code. It's really that's like a boardroom I kind of want to hang out in or a meeting and conference room. So that was Scott Phoenix, co-founder and CEO of Vicarious. I tried not to talk to him all day, but I
could have. he's like scary smart. And what is he, like 30? I mean, it's killing me.
I know. I don't even want to. I just try not to. I try to close my eyes whenever I talk to people in the Valley because they're all so young and brilliant. Not all of them. I shouldn't say all of them are because that's not true. Some of them are young and not brilliant. Yeah. Anyway, hey.
That was Scott.
So if you go to our website, Make Me Smart, it's marketplace.org/makemesmart. You can see that last week we are trying to make this a full transmedia experience.
No,
you will see us
on
the Twitter.
Phrase. You're on fire today,
Facebook.
Transmedia and businesses checks and balance. You're rocking it. I'm just like the
sidekick
today.
I can't take any credit for transmedia. I can totally take credit for the other thing, but not transmedia. Right. That's like a completely cheeseball marketing term that I adore. It just makes me laugh so hard. We're not on like TV yet, but we're everywhere else, everyone. But you will see that we posted a bunch of articles that addressed some of your comments after our first show. We're going to try to do that every week because we want the show to be a conversation with you, not just talking at you, but also not just addressing your questions on this particular recording. But afterwards.
Right. Because if you don't hear us talking about it on the podcast, check the website one more time. It's marketplace.org/makemesmart. We are going to be right back with Norman Lear, 94 years young. The guy is unbelievable. But first, we got to pay the bills.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.
So one of the great things about our job, as you are probably going to hear us say, I think we said this identically last week. One of the greatest things about being a journalist, period, is you get to talk to so many fascinating people.
I got to talk to Norman Lear this week. As I said up at the top, he's 94 years old. He started All in the Family and Maude and One Day at a Time, did a bunch of stuff. He was in the studio the other day with his co-creator of a reboot of One Day at a Time. It's on Netflix. Her name is Gloria Calderon Kellett. And that interview is coming up on the radio air sometime soon. But we asked, I was going to say Mr. Lear, but he literally specifically told me I could call him Norman. I asked him the Make Me Smart question, which is, what's something you thought you knew that later it turned out you were wrong about? And before we go, there is one bad word in here. So if you got kids in the back, it's the bad word. So, you know.
I didn't or wouldn't, if anybody had asked me, have said that I was capable of murder. And I was capable for 35 instances that I can recount because I flew missions. I was a radio operator gunner in a B-17. And in World War II. And only within the last couple of years, my wife and I were visiting friends in Berlin, and we were flying to Berlin, and it's the first time I'd been there since I bombed it. And our crew, we bombed it. And so I had to remember, I was the radio operator, I was closest to the bomb bay doors, so I was the guy who got up a little bit out of his chair and leaned over to let the pilot know that the last bomb had left the bay and he could close the doors. That was my role every mission. So I saw our bombs leave the bomb bay, and then I saw them gather with all the bombs from around the other planes flying in our squadron. I'd watch, you know, hundreds of bombs falling. And I recall thinking each time, what if all those bombs, one of them, seven of them, you know, miss a target? What if they hit a farmhouse? And I even imagined a family sitting around a table. And if I could say, fuck it, I would say that, but I know I'm on radio. But that's the way I felt. Within hours, flying back to the base and everything else, I recall so well asking myself, you know, if somebody came to me with a piece of paper and a pencil and said, Mr. Lear, if you sign this, you will forever mean that. I know, like I know my name, I would never sign such a piece of paper. But the fact is, for a moment, I did. Which tells me we are all capable of the worst and the best, the most transcendent behavior, the worst evil.
Right?
I mean, what do you do with that tape? It's unbelievable.
That is like the most profound and timeless and powerful thing that everyone should remember.
Yeah.
Ever. I mean, that's coming directly from, you know, the Greatest Generation.
Right. Oh, yeah. And if I don't live to be 94, I'm going to be PO'd, man.
That full interview, as Kai mentioned, with Norman Lear and his co-creator of the rebooted One Day at a Time, Gloria Calderon, coming up soon on Marketplace. Yep. I also brought a little bit. I didn't get to participate in that interview. Yeah, but I brought back a little commentary of my own, because in between last time we did the show and you know this time, I bolted for Hawaii. where I attempted to get some commentary that I hope will also give us a little sense of perspective.
Oh, all right.
Here's that tape.
Okay. What the hell is that?
I talked to this whale.
No,
he was right under my boat.
Really?
Yeah, this is totally true. This is a humpback whale. This is a lone male, which they like to call a singer. And he was right under the boat, and we dropped a little device over the side so that we could hear him.
No way.
So I call this my whale on the street tape.
Is it a happy? What did the experts say? Is he a happy whale or is he a sad whale?
Okay, so here's some crazy trivia about humpback whales.
Yeah.
No one knows why they do this.
Well, that's like me singing in the shower. Nobody knows why I sing in the shower, but
right.
But is he happy?
Nobody knows why the whales do it. Only humpbacks do it, and only the males do it, and no one knows why. And this is so crazy that the song from whale to whale to whale is the same basically every migration season. So, like, if you record this upside down male humpback whale in Alaska singing his lonely little song, and then you compare it to like my guy in Maui who's chilling under my boat singing me a song, it's all about me. So, they will be the same.
Okay, wait. So is that like the same whale in Alaska and the same whale in Maui, or is
it?
No, come on, really?
I'm telling you,
it's like they're connected by some unknown neural network or something.
Yes, exactly.
That's
like Scott
freaky.
Phoenix would probably have. We should probably tell him about this.
Oh,
he should probably use this in his research. Yeah, it was fascinating, and it was just a good. You know what it was? It was a really nice reset and bit of perspective for me, because that whale down there, he doesn't care.
Because he's in the waters off Hawaii. I wouldn't care. Would you care?
Here.
Come on.
I did not. I'm
good
just saying
grief.
That for 4 days, y'all.
You're lucky you came back.
I did not care.
God. All right. Listen, don't forget to rate us in iTunes. Leave us a review. It does help other people find us. We are also on Google Play. I think it's a little tricky to find us in Google Play, but please find us and review
Search
us
for
and
Marketplace.
Rate us. And,
you That's know, our tip.
Be gentle. Be gentle. Oh,
but please, the ratings really do help. And Google Play, just as a little from me to you, search for Marketplace, and that is how you will find Make Me Smart. And don't forget to join us next Monday on Facebook at 10:30 a.m. Pacific time. We'll be on probably Kai's page, facebook.com/KaiRizdahl. And that is our show for today. See you next time.
Make Me Smart is produced by Jenny Josephson, Bridget Bodner, and the senior producer around here, Nancy Fargali. This week's program was engineered by Daniel Ramirez. Our theme music is composed by Ben Talladay and Daniel Ramirez.
The executive producer of Marketplace is one Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark, because ladies are in charge around here.
That's totally true.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.